Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, you can pick an experienced, licensed therapist you relate to and feel comfortable with. Each and every therapist has at least a master's degree and has completed over 3,000 hours of supervised work. To match with your perfect therapist, go to Talkspace.com/boom. And to show your support for this podcast, use code BOOM to get $30 off your first month. That's BOOM, Talkspace.com/boom, B-O-O-M.
You are Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast on the Houston Rockets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome to a brand new episode of Locked On Rockets, your home for daily podcast coverage of the Houston Rockets. I'm your host, Ben Dubose. As we chat on this Monday, it's an off day. The Rockets got back to Houston late last night after their Sunday afternoon win in Oklahoma City. That gave them a 3-1 lead in the best of seven series. They're now one win away from advancing to the second round. They can do that Tuesday night at Toyota Center in Game 5. So they got back last night. They got a good night's rest, and then they're in Houston, so they reported to practice at noon today. They're obviously putting a lot of intensity on this game. We've heard from lots of players, Trevor Ariza, James Harden, that they're treating this like a Game 7 because it's not easy to win in Oklahoma City. The Rockets actually trail for the vast majority of those two games, and if it goes to Game 6, it's hard not to see it as a 50-50 proposition. And from there, you're looking at a potential Game 7. So the Rockets have a lot of incentive to get this done early. There's also the matter of James Harden's ankle, which he admitted after the game yesterday was rolled. He downplayed it today, said he's fine, but James always says that. When you have any injury at all involving your star player, all of the rest you can get is important. And if the Rockets close this out tomorrow night, they don't have to play again for 6 whole days, not until Monday, May 1st. That's the opening of the second round. So this is a big opportunity for the Rockets in Game 5, Tuesday at 7 at Toyota Center, to go out and close out the series in commanding form. We haven't seen them have a true statement win since Game 1, but I think the Thunder, they're emotionally reeling a little bit after letting it get away yesterday, a game that certainly they were in the driver's seat. So it's an opportunity for the Rockets to put the hammer down, advance to the second round, and get themselves a lot of rest in the process, all while the Spurs and Grizzlies, that's the teams they can potentially play in the second round, go through a heavyweight slugfest that seems destined for 6 or 7 games. So to break down how the Rockets can get it done, or, well, how they might not, in tomorrow's all-important Game 5, I'm going to be joined again by Fred Katz. He is the Thunder beat writer for the Norman Transcript. He's also the host of Locked On Thunder, the sister podcast on this Locked On Podcast Network. Had him on the show last week. Thought he did a great job breaking down the series after Game 1 and previewing what adjustments, many of them successfully executed by the Thunder in Games 2, 3, and 4. So I'm bringing him back on to kind of get a new taste of where this series is at in Oklahoma City's mind, get a pulse on how they're viewing it up there, and whether he thinks this thing's likely to end tomorrow or if he thinks there's a good shot for the series to go on to Game 6. So to break down everything, not just from a Rockets perspective, but for a Thunder perspective too, I'm going to be joined in just a second by Fred. So if you bear with me, I will get him connected right now. Ben Dubose here, Fred Katz there, another joint Locked On Rockets, Locked On Thunder preview show, this time looking ahead to tomorrow's Game 5 in Houston. Fred, I know you're getting ready to jump on a plane to get back down here for the second and potentially final time. What are your thoughts? I know you went to practice today in Oklahoma City. I was with the Rockets practice in Houston because, of course, the Thunder did not travel until this afternoon. So early impressions, takeaways, what's your sense going into this game?
It does kind of seem like the end for the Thunder, doesn't it? I mean, they've had leads. They've had double-digit leads in 3 consecutive games. They could honestly be up 3-1 right now. I'm not saying they should be up 3-1.
Yeah.
But they could be up 3-1. They led by 15 in Game 2. They lost that game. They led by 15 in Game 3. They won that game by 2. And they led by 14 in the second half of Game 4. They absolutely could have won Games 2 and Games 4 or Game 2 or Game 4. And this series is totally different. It's split heading back to Game 5 or you know, the Thunder actually have a 3-1 lead and they're looking to potentially either close it out in Game 5 or come home and close it out in Game 6. So, I mean, they hold on to those leads. This series is totally different. But it does kind of seem like it got away from them. Fourth quarter execution was so poor, honestly, from both teams in Game 4. But I think even worse for the Thunder. And it messed them all up, and now they got, you know, it does seem like their backs are against the wall heading on the road for a Game 5, down 3-1.
I would say that's the sense here as well, but I would say a 3-1 lead, spare all the, you know, Warriors 3-1 jokes, Indians, all the random stuff we've heard over the past year. This 3-1 lead in itself does feel a little more tenuous just based on how close the games have been. Also, the matter of James Harden's ankle, which he admitted to after the game yesterday. There's a lot of incentive for the Rockets to try and wrap this up quickly. Both of those games in Oklahoma City, it's one of those situations. I would say game two in Houston was a little different because game two in Houston, you actually did have a stretch from about the 3-minute mark of the third quarter all the way through up until about 2 minutes left when the Rockets went up 10, where the Rockets actually did put the hammer down, outscored the Thunder by 20, 25 points. For the vast majority of these two games in Oklahoma City, the Thunder held leads anywhere from 5 to 15. So even though they couldn't close it out, it felt like those two games, for the most part, Oklahoma City was playing from in front. So I don't think there's a whole heck of a lot of confidence if the series goes to a game 6 that it's anything better than a 50-50 shot. And then from there, all of a sudden, if it gets to a game 7, all the pressure would be squarely on the Rockets as the favored team, having had this lead. And well, even if they were to win an eventual game 7, I think the physical fatigue that it would take on the Rockets would definitely have a damaging long-term effect. So all the talk down here has been treating this game 5 like a game 7. And in a sense, you almost have to, because if it gets back to Oklahoma City, as I said, I think it has to be a 50-50 proposition at best. So there's a lot of reasons, Harden's injury status, all those other factors that the Rockets really want to close this thing out tomorrow, and it's going to be interesting to see what they do. My sense is that they'll probably still start Clint Capella, but that's the biggest takeaway down here, is the enormous discrepancy between Nene, who, of course, 28 points, 10 rebounds, 12 of 12 shooting. It's just comedic, his numbers against the Thunder this year, literally shooting 85% from the field. And then you contrast that with Clint Capella, who really the Rockets could have won both of these games by double digits if they had even average production from Capella, and instead he's just been downright terrible. So I think the situation for the Rockets, they're trying to find the delicate balance between, okay, how do we keep Capella's confidence high? I don't think they want to bench him because I think in theory the Spurs matchup is a lot friendlier to Capella than Steven Adams and the Thunder. But at the same time, you also have to, there's the balance of this game 5, they say they're going to treat it like a game 7. And while I don't know if with a 3-1 lead they're going to change the starting lineup, it would not shock me at all if they had a pretty quick hook if the Thunder got out to another 8 to 10 point lead, which they've done for 3 consecutive games now in the first quarter.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Capella was a minus 25 in a game that his team won by 4. And Nene was a plus 24. Like, talk about an outrageous difference. I don't know what the Thunder are going to do about Nene. Like, he is on another level when he plays against this team. And here's the thing. A lot of these shots are, they're all around the basket. I mean, a lot of them are open dumps. They're open dunks. They're dump-offs. They're kind of little, just kind of like dinky layups that he's able to get in around the basket. Mm-hmm. And that's not to take away anything from him, because I think he's done more than the scoring. Like, you look at 12 for 12, and that's incredible. I don't care if they're all dunks. 12 for 12 in an NBA game, in a playoff game, is an incredible performance. And he was just amazing and unstoppable with the way he's able to find space, open himself up. And he did have a couple of really nice moves in the post. The impressive thing about him is he's not holding on to the ball. He rarely ever touches it for more than a couple of seconds. And he made some great passes in that game, too. In transition, getting the ball around getting the ball around the paint and kicking the shooters in the corner. He did that a few times. He's made some great, like, ball-moving passes. Even if they didn't always go into assists, he's made a couple of really, really great ball-moving passes to keep the offense moving. Like, even when he's 12 for 12, he's not stalling the offense. And Houston always moves the ball well. Harden dribbles a lot, obviously, similarly to Russ, but he moves the ball well, and Houston moves the ball well, and they move the ball well with their bench unit, too. And when he's out there and he's scoring like that, and he's still able to move the ball like that, he's not stalling the offense, he's not just getting his, and he's actually being a productive offensive player all around, man, like, that is tough. He is really tough to defend when he's playing like that.
Yeah, and the Rockets did a really good job throughout the season of managing his minutes. On my post-game show yesterday, I made the analogy of comparing it to, you know, a horse that they just know to crack the whip at the right time, you know, that's just pacing himself, because limited to 18 to 20 minutes, gave him the Tim Duncan rest treatment, that sort of stuff on back-to-backs, random games throughout the year. So I think the Rockets, to their credit, Mike D'Antoni has said throughout the year that he thinks Nene, when healthy, is still a top 5 center. And a lot of us in the Houston media, behind his back, have kind of sickered at it, saying, come on, really? But you see a game like yesterday and really a series like this, and all of a sudden you see what he's seeing. Now, is he really a top five center? No, because he's not able to do it on a, you know, a larger basis. You can't just extrapolate it to 30, 35, 40 minutes because it doesn't work that way. But in the 25 minutes that he can play now, he can be that impactful. So he's not entirely wrong. You look at games like yesterday and you can see what he's seeing. Now, as far as Capella, the flip side to this, what I'm really struck by in these past couple of games is just how impactful Steven Adams can be. And maybe I shouldn't be saying that because, of course, anyone who watched Oklahoma City in last season's playoff run became aware of that. But really, games one and game two in Houston were kind of weird from an Adams perspective because game one, you had all the just the ridiculous switching, the poor execution, and so it basically took Adams and Cantor away from the basket, so it kind of mitigated their impact. Capella torched them on lobs. That was, of course, when Cantor was playing more. You had the can't play Cantor, you know, mouthing from Billy, all that sort of stuff. And then in game two, that was when Capella got in foul trouble. And I don't think it was a coincidence that when he picked up the fourth foul midway through the third quarter and the fifth early in the fourth, it was right after that that Capella went to work. That was when he really dominated against Sabonis, against Cantor, et cetera, et cetera. These last two games in Oklahoma City, now you could say that they called the officials, and that was a very oddly called game yesterday for both sides. The officials, they did call some pretty touchy fouls on the perimeter in terms of jump shots, but in terms of activity near the bucket on drives, they let a lot more go. Adams only had one foul, and so because he was able to stay out of foul trouble, play 37 minutes, you got to see the full Steven Adams experience, and he's tough. You know, Nene has the physicality to, you know, to kind of offset that and play with him. But I think if Steven Adams playing at full strength, not limited by fouls, that combination of agility and power is something that Clint Capella, basically just in his second full season, 22 years old, it's awfully tough for Clint. I think Clint, those first two games, benefited from, you know, the defensive problems in game one and then the foul trouble in game two. A full-strength Steven Adams against Clint Capella is a big problem for Clinton. I think that's what stood out to me the last two games.
He's a really good team defender, too.
Yeah.
He's generally good. A lot of the times when they do give up those lobs, it's because whoever it is on the weak side doesn't always pull over in time to take away that lob. And they've done a much better job of that this series. I actually think if you can pinpoint one thing that they've done really well, their team defense in this series has been really strong.
Yep.
Like, Houston's obviously had some incredible offensive spurts because they're one of the best offenses in the last 10 years. Like, that's going to happen no matter how impressive your defense is throughout a series. There are going to be spurts where the Rockets catch fire and they play really well. But they've done a great job taking away threes. They've done a good job since game one on pick and rolls. Done a really good job coming over and helping on those lobs and that kind of stuff. And Adams is really good at simultaneously guarding against the lob, guarding against the potential pocket pass to the roller, while also cutting off a driving lane to the basket.
Yep.
He's really good at positioning himself like that. I mean, he's really bright with X's nose and that kind of stuff. His basketball knowledge is super, super impressive. So you factor that in along with the physicality and just kind of – he's one of the strongest guys in the league.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's a massive guy. He's just a solid, solid human being. Like, he's the type of person I feel like if I wind up and just run right into him, he's just he won't move. There's just no way he's gonna move, and he's that kind of body. He's that kind of like stable strength with kind of how like he decked Patrick Beverly on that screen. Like that's the unmovable sort of Steven Adams, and that's tough. That's tough against Capella. Capella's agile and he's athletic and he's really good at a lot of stuff. But Adams is just a lot stronger than him, just in terms of just like brute strength and physicality. And those are the types that he can tend to bother. There are types that play against him well too, but those are the types that he can bother a little bit more because he's so physical and people, I mean, guys going against him, just everyone seems to have a problem with him. I mean, it was Harden yesterday who was, you know, just shoving him in the backcourt after he was giving him a shoulder, and they, you know, any playoff series, you know, last year he got into it with Zaza Pachulia, and then, you know, he got into it with Draymond Green, and he doesn't get into it with anybody on the Spurs because who gets into anything
right
with anyone on the Spurs? But it seems like every non-Spurs playoff series, you know, and before that, it's been Zach Randolph punched him.
Yeah.
Like, he got suspended in the playoff series a few years ago. Like, guys get annoyed with Steven Adams. And I don't know if it's because he's dirty or if he's annoying or however you wanna call it, but he's, you know, that type of aggravator. There's no question about that.
Yeah, and you could see it getting under James Harden's skin a lot in Game 4. I think part of it for James, and I said it on my show, it's just something he's got to get better at, is playing through the officiating, especially on the road. Sometimes you're going to get calls, others you didn't. We saw early in the series, he had these games with 20-plus free-throw attempts. He got the whistles. Yesterday, he did not. He got a little bit frustrated, and really, you know, they called a foul. They could have also called a technical if they wanted on one of those shoves he had of Steven Adams, and that's something that James has just got to filter out, because when you're in a playoff environment, especially on the road, sometimes you're going to get the whistles, and sometimes you aren't. And as you said, Steven, you know, he gets under people's skin. That's what he does, and it's not dirty. Quite frankly, it's an asset in terms of what he can bring to Oklahoma City. The other thing that really struck me about the Thunder, and I saw someone on my Twitter timeline say the other day that Oklahoma City is a matchup nightmare for everybody. And it's kind of funny because you think matchup nightmare, okay, then why are they a 16? Why are they 47-35? But I started thinking about it, they're such a unique combination, especially in terms of the defensive end, because it's not just Steven, it's Oladipo, it's Andre Robertson, the excessive length that they have at every position. Obviously Russ, even though Russ isn't a good defender, he still has that, you know, that quick twitch athleticism that makes him dangerous to get a big steal at any particular point. And I think that's something we've seen in these late game possessions for the Rockets in Game 2 and Game 4 when they have a call timeout and it's been a true scramble open court situation. That length gives them problems. And so I think, you know, you can question how the pieces fit together for Oklahoma City. Maybe that's why it's just a sixth seed. But from a, you know, how it matches up with the Rockets, and, well, anybody else for that matter, you don't see many teams with the length, the athleticism, the power up and down the roster that the Thunder have. And I'll say the defense, their ability to prevent Houston from getting their usual looks, it's as good as anybody I've seen all year long. Now, for the first three games, Houston largely offset that with Harden being just phenomenal, playing out of his mind. Game 4 was the first non-MVP level performance that we had from Harden, and so because of that, that's when you finally saw the offense get really sluggish, and if not for, you know, Nene having basically a playoff career game, there's no way that Houston wins that game yesterday. So yeah, Oklahoma City, you know, it starts with Adams, but boy, defensively, it feels a little bit like quite a shame, because they have some really unique parts that I don't know how well they fit together, but they can cause anybody, even a really great offense like Houston, a lot of problems with just the number, the length of athletes that the Thunder have.
The problem with this roster is that it's overridden with specialists.
True.
There are a lot of guys who play one end of the floor. There aren't really a lot of two-way guys. You know, Oladipo plays two ways. Taj Gibson plays two ways. But you kind of look at it, Jeremy Grant, you know, has some offensive value, but for the most part, he's, you know, an athletic defender who's raw and you're not really going to give the ball to or anything like that. Alex Abrines is a shooter who's still learning how to play defense. Doug McDermott, shooter, still learning how to play defense. Enes Kanter, excellent low post offensive player, not playable in this series because of his defense. I mean, you look at a lot of these guys, Andre Robertson, all defense caliber guy, maybe the best hardened defender in the league, certainly in the conversation for that. And he's had a great series, but you know, as we saw at the free throw line during Game 4, there are a lot of offensive problems with Andre Robertson. So it's really hard. You know, Russell Westbrook had a really, really down defensive season. Now, I think he's been better defensively during the postseason, especially following Game 1, where I really thought he wasn't good at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's been better during this series than he was during the regular season. That's not to say he's been great by any means defensively, but I just think he's been better, a little bit more disciplined, although he gambled a lot in Game 4. Once he got that poke from behind on a pick and roll to force a steal early in the game, you just kind of said, like, all right, he's obviously going to be going for this a lot. And he got another one later in the game, too. But, you know, he was still gambling a lot in that game. But he's been more disciplined. He's been, I think, a higher effort guy, which is probably to be expected in the playoffs. But there just aren't a lot of guys in this team that you can look at and say, all right, that guy is at least above average as a defensive player and above average as an offensive player, which is, I think, part of why you see Billy Donovan play a gazillion different types of lineups, because it's hard to do that. When you've got five guys on the team, just five guys who are at least average defensively and at least average offensively, you can more easily piece together a lineup that says, all right, we're stable at each of these positions. Even four, we're stable at almost all these positions and almost all these parts on the court. We're going to have reliable guys out there. And the Thunder have so few of those guys that I think Donovan ends up trying to match up against everybody. I don't know if it's necessarily his overall preference, independent of who they're playing and what team he has. But with this team, I think he feels like he has to do that because of the way the roster is comprised.
Yeah. You mentioned the name Andre Robertson. I wanted to hit on that, the hack of Robertson, which is something that's been talked about a lot, I'm sure, in Oklahoma City, and it definitely has been here. I'm curious your take both from a tactical and an emotional standpoint. I mentioned emotional because I think I saw a tweet from you after the game referencing, you know, kind of the somber nature in the locker room and Andre not really wanting to take a lot of questions about it. So I'm curious what the vibe is from just a team culture standpoint, and then from a tactical standpoint, your read on it. I thought it was a really smart move by Mike D'Antoni. I've been asked constantly on my Twitter feed throughout the series, do you think they should go hack a Robertson? And I think, yeah, it makes a lot of sense because someone shoots 43%, and if the Thunder, especially Russ, gets really hot, why wouldn't you think about doing it? Certainly, people in Houston are more knowledgeable of that strategy than anywhere, because in Houston, we've seen it deployed time and time again against Dwight Howard and Josh Smith the last 3 years. But if you do it earlier, if you do it in the second quarter of game two, something like that, then maybe all of a sudden the Thunder, Robertson, they're more familiar with it, as opposed to you wait until the fourth quarter of game four, a meaningful game on the road. There's less time for Donovan, for Robertson to really adjust to it, and maybe that's what let it play out for a couple more possessions that it might have if they had shown a willingness to do that earlier in the series, kind of the shock value component. So that's why I thought it was a good move by Mike D'Antoni, not just strategically, but to time it the way he did. But I'm curious your read on it from up there.
I think it was a good move. I think it was a good move. It got Robertson off the floor for a minute and a half when Harden was really struggling against him. So I think that works as well. And I think that was probably a major contributor as to why they decided to do it at that time, too. Just getting him off on a night when look, Harden was playing great. I mean, Robertson's played great defense on him all series, but Harden was playing great in each of those first three games. Now I think they felt like they had to get Robertson off the floor to give Harden a break. And I think they felt that a little bit more in game four, which is something that contributed to it as well. I thought it was a good move. I didn't necessarily think it was a move. I think a lot of people have been as that's what won him the game.
Not really.
I don't think that. I don't think that was the case. I mean, they were. I realize you have to look at this partially on a points per possession basis. And Robertson went 2 for 8 on those hacking free throws on 4 possessions going to the line. So that's obviously, you know, 2 points in 4 possessions. Obviously, it worked to a degree. But the Rockets were up 3 when they started doing it, and they were up 2 when they stopped. Now I realize that it's easy to say, well, the hacking is just affecting the Thunder offense, but that's not really the case, because I think part of what's so good about the Rockets offense is that they're able to force mismatches in transition so well. They're able to get open shots in transition, threes. And when I say in transition, I don't necessarily mean on the fast break in the first 7 seconds of the shot clock. I mean secondary break. You know, Harden comes down. They freak out because Harden's rushing it down. A big man ends up on Harden. A small ends up on Nene. A big ends up on Gordon in the corner or something and doesn't know how to defend it. And you end up getting a really good, really efficient look. And that's how the Rockets get a lot of their shots. When they're hacking, they're not going to get those offensive possessions. They're working out of the half court. And even the best offensive teams, they're worse in the half court than they are in transition. Rockets get a ton of their points in transition, too, so I think that's even more exaggerated. It's not like they're a bad half-court offense, but they're more prone to stalling, just like any team in the NBA. You look at average half-court offense versus average transition offense, and teams are 20% worse in the half-court. That's just the way it is. So I don't necessarily love it, but I definitely thought – I mean, people are saying, you know, it made a – I don't think it made as much of an impact as necessarily the narrative says that it did, but I do think it was a smart tactical move getting Robertson out of the game. And obviously, you know, he's you know, one of the worst free throw shooters in the league. And I think to some degree it demoralized him a little bit. He was like, I tweeted out, he specifically looked just distraught after the game. And he was like, Jenna Carlson from the Oklahoman asked him about it, about the free throws. And I asked him about the free throws. To both of us, he just said, next question. And it wasn't in like that aggressive Russell Westbrook next question way. Where, like, shooting it down.
It was more than despondent. Like, yeah.
Yeah, he was just, like, really he kind of looked like he was, like, he looked really sad. Like, I've never seen him look like this. And he's a super nice guy. He's extremely cooperative with media always. He always talks, whether he plays well or he plays poorly. He always talks to the media, and like he did not mean it in a move on, next question, I'm not talking about it kind of way. I think he meant it in a, like, I cannot bring myself to talk about that right now kind of way. And he just kind of subtly under his breath said, next question. And I think if you can have that psychological effect on someone, I think that contributes to it being a solid move too. I mean, you know, I felt bad for him. I felt so bad for him, just like as another human being sitting there seeing him like that. He just seemed so – him and Jeremy Grant after that foul line – Nini late too. Two of them just seemed really, really despondent after the game. And, you know, you don't like being in that position as a reporter because you just don't like, absolutely, it's not fun to be around sad people. That's not a fun thing. But to some degree, I think they were, I mean, there was a different feel from a lot, not everyone, but there was a different feel from a lot of the guys after this game than there's been in any other moment this season.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I thought it worked. As you said, it wasn't a brilliant tactical move. You can just look at the raw numbers for that, but I thought it helped the Rockets in a couple of ways. First, as you said, with Harden, it got him going. That's it wasn't a good game for James, but he was at least able to get a couple of shots late, and so not having Robertson out there helped him get into rhythm a bit. I thought that was meaningful. And then beyond that, you had it's essentially stalled momentum for everyone. That's a point, maybe I'm jaded after seeing so many Russell Westbrook moments in the last 5 minutes of close games, and of course the close attention we pay to the MVP race here in Houston. But that was a stretch, close game, national TV at home. I expected any moment now, okay, here's going to come the run. Here's going to come where Russell Westbrook catches fire, that crowd just gets out of control, so loud. And it never came because that just made the game so disjointed. And so I thought, while it wasn't a traditional, you know, it wasn't a move you can say mathematically, here's why it worked. I thought emotionally it injected, I don't know if it injected something into the Rockets, but it really stalled out the Thunder in a lot of ways. And so I'm curious how that translates to Game 5, because as you said, now that it's been used.
Yeah, well, also just to really cut you off.
No, go ahead.
There are a lot of people who think, I mean, Hacking is most commonly used when the team doing the hacking is trailing. But there are a lot of people who believe that it's best used when your team's ahead because you're taking away. Mm-hmm. When a team comes back, whether it's from like, you know, down five with 2 minutes left or whatever it is, for the most part, when a team comes back in 2017, it's because they made threes. And you're taking away the three-point shot, which is your best weapon for a comeback. It's your absolute best weapon for a comeback, whether you like the three-point shot or not. Three-point shot is your best weapon for a late-night comeback, late-game comeback, for every obvious reason. And when you hack, you're taking away the three. And that's kind of the point that you were making. You know, that's a lot of those Westbrook comebacks, he hit at least a couple of threes in a lot of those late-game situations.
Yeah, because of that, just another example I'll throw in there, I did not think it was a dumb foul what Nene did to Steven Adams after the bizarre Harden turnover where he got up in the air with nowhere to go with 20 seconds left and the Rockets were up 5. I did not mind the foul. First off, Steven Adams is not an automatic free throw shooter. And secondly, you're taking away the shot of Russell or someone hitting a pull-up three, getting it to 2. Now, unfortunately, as it ended up, you know, just a perfect miss right back to Steven, who kicked it to Russ and ended up being a 4-point play and almost giving the Thunder a shot to steal the game. But in theory, I didn't mind the Nene foul at all. Mathematically, I'm fine with fouling there, especially a not great free throw shooter, rather than give the Thunder a shot at a 3 to cut it to 2. It just so happens that you can have the right strategy, and then if the ball bounces a certain way, it still doesn't work. So yeah, I'm right there with you. It's a weapon. It doesn't have to be when you're trailing. It can also be when you're ahead. Fred, I know we got to wrap up in the next couple of minutes, so keys to Game 5, final things to talk about for both of these two teams. Rockets obviously hoping to finish it off, whereas the Thunder trying to stay live, force it to Game 6 on Thursday. I'll start with my keys for the Rockets. You can give yours for the Thunder. To me, for Houston, it's about getting the starting lineup going. I'm not so much worried about James Harden. He's been brilliant this series. You do give a lot of credit to Robertson, who's defended him well, but in 3 or 4 games, Robertson has defended James, and he still played phenomenally well. I'm more inclined to just say yesterday's a one-off. He didn't act too concerned about the ankle today at practice, so I think James is going to get going, especially at home. What the Rockets have got to do, they've outplayed the Thunder generally for the last 40 minutes of games. It's the first 8 to 10 minutes that have been such an enormous problem for this club. And, of course, it goes to Ariza, Ryan Anderson, and Capella, basically your starters that aren't James Harden and Pat Beverley. Well, you can even include Pat Beverley because Beverley was just 2 of 13 yesterday. So there's the old axiom that role players shoot better at home. Certainly that was the case for the Thunder. You had Oladipo, Robertson, a lot of guys shooting even better in Oklahoma City than they did in Houston. So you got to hope that same effect happens for the Rockets. I thought Ariza did a good job of getting going yesterday, creating his own offense, even when the threes weren't there. And you just have to hope that Pat Beverley can get back in the grind that he was at in game one when I thought he attacked a little bit more. He seemed content to be a stationary shooter yesterday. And then Ryan Anderson, I don't know what it is with him. He's been out of sorts all series. Clint Capella, we discussed him earlier. But yeah, it's finding ways, I think, especially early in the game to get Anderson, Capella, Beverley, get them some shots. I think part of the issue against Oklahoma City, Oklahoma City's defense is so good. The Rockets don't get the volume of shots, especially threes. You discussed this earlier. They do against most teams. And so if they start off slow, it's tough for them to get into rhythm because they're not getting the shots. They're not getting the repetitions. And especially if they're in Oklahoma City, you have the crowd working against you. And Houston, friendlier crowd, get them off to a big start. To me, that's the key for the Rockets. If they can involve those other guys, I think there's a good shot that the Rockets can end this thing in game five.
Yeah, I think for the Thunder, I think they need to continue to limit those threes, which is something they've done a really good job on. But that's easier to do at home than it is on the road. They did it in games one and two, even though they lost those. But that's something they need to continue to do. Not necessarily three-point makes, because who knows? That's not necessarily limited by the defense. If guys are going to make shots, they're going to make shots. But you can limit attempts, and they've done a really good – the Rockets average 43-point attempts in this game, and they have 43-point attempts this season. Mm-hmm. They haven't taken 40 in a game yet this series. I mean, that's in part because they've been really good around the rim and they've just been going to the rim a lot. It's also in part because the Thunder have done a good job limiting those shots. I think they've done a good job forcing the Rockets away from a lot of shots that they otherwise would be taking. Number two, I would just say holding on to leads is something with that. And that I mean, that sounds, you know, so, you know, easier said than done. Mm-hmm. But like part of it, the bench unit comes out yesterday. They were plus 14 with Westbrook gone and minus 18 with them off. The bench unit is putting up shots with 12 seconds left on the shot clock. That bench unit needs to be playing at the most viscous pace you've ever seen anybody play in. When Russell Westbrook is off, they need to be playing as – they need to limit as few – like that needs to be as few possessions as they possibly can from that bench unit. And they need to play as slow as possible because of that. And Norris Cole putting out threes with 12 seconds left or whatever it is, they can't do that. Mm-hmm. I think they gotta, if they're gonna play Cantor, just run the offense as opposed to Cantor. That's kind of what they did when Oladipo got hurt in the middle of the year. Cantor's got experience with that. He actually had a really nice month and a half, 2 month stretch where he was passing really well, facilitating the second unit. And during that stretch, the Thunder had like 112 offensive rating when Cantor was on and Westbrook was off. Like it was extraordinarily efficient offense they were running because Cantor was playing so well at the post. He's such a good low post player. If you're going to play him, you might as well feature him like that because that's how you're going to get the most out of him. And you can play at a much slower pace if that's what you end up doing. So I think that's something that they have to concentrate on with their bench unit, and that can kind of help sustain those leads when they lose them. That's not how they've always lost leads, but it's something that's really, really hurt them. They need good Russ. Like there's as every Rockets fan has now seen if you watch the first four games, there's good Russ and there's bad Russ. And good Russ and bad Russ doesn't come in different games. It comes on different possessions. And, like, there are points, like, in the fourth quarter. Like, Westbrook still had 18 points in the fourth quarter yesterday. There are points where he's doing those post-ups on Patrick Beverley over and over again at 16 feet. It's like, those are not efficient possessions. He's doing it because he's getting frustrated with Beverley. You know, the two threes that were wild with a half a minute left to go in the game, those are wild and bad shots. They can't have those. They need him playing like he did, you know, in the first half of that game, distributing and pushing pace. Like their pace has gone way down in the second half of games. It's gone way down in the second half of games, and that's partly on Westbrook controlling the pace. I think that's something they need to concentrate on as well, and that just kind of all ties into the best version of Westbrook. And if they get the best version of Westbrook, they can win. Just like on any given night when the Rockets get the best version of Harden, they can beat anybody too. So they need to get the best version of Westbrook, and a lot of that just comes down to decision-making and style over all else.
Yep. Well, Fred, I know you got to run. I know you got to catch the flight to Houston, so I enjoyed catching up with you, and I'll see you at Toyota Center tomorrow night. All right, man?
Cool. Great to see you.
Sounds good. That's Fred Katz, Thunder beat writer for the Norman Transcript, also host of Locked On Thunder, the sister podcast to us here at Locked On Rockets on the Locked On Podcast Network. Thought he hit home all the major points. He's one of the better young beat writers in the league, so I always enjoy being able to talk with him. One thing we didn't talk about, but I should give him credit for, he was actually the guy who broke the story about Pat Beverly and the fan confrontation. Now, I'm saying fan confrontation, you can't see it in air quotes, because it's not really a fan. It's the son of Oklahoma City's minority owner. So, yeah, to me, he has even a bigger responsibility not to get in a situation like that than an average fan does. Not that it's condonable for an average fan, but it's certainly not for the son of an owner sitting in an owner's seat right next to the court. So I give credit to Fred, because whatever we all think about it, it is a story. He was the first to find out. He reported it Saturday afternoon. He was in communication with the owner's son, so that was a big get for him. Other reason I didn't necessarily want to ask him about it, first off, it's inconsequential. Whatever, it's over with, and what we're left with on both sides. Obviously, the Thunder fans thought Beverly should have been suspended. Those of us in Houston, I don't think he even should have been fined. There's hard feelings on both sides because the Thunder, well, they lost the game, and there's no suspension in Houston. Beverly was fined and over something that he thought never should have happened, and really he thought the NBA should have taken care of when he pointed out during the game that the fan was, you know, yelling profanities at him and doing things that were inappropriate for a fan there. Other reason I didn't want to bring it up to Fred, I don't want to put him in an awkward spot. He doesn't work for the team. Those are definitely not his bosses. He is a newspaper reporter. However, certainly he's around the Thunder on a daily basis. He depends on them to do his job. So I didn't want to put him, if you follow me on Twitter, at Penn DuBose, you know I have some very strong opinions on that. And I don't want to put him in an awkward position where he's having to, you know, either defend, go along with, whatever, my opinions on this, because I think it's just ridiculous that the Thunder organization has put up with this. I really think that from Clay Bennett on down, all the way through Sam Presti, Billy Donovan, Russell Westbrook, someone needs to condone it, because to me, piecing together what happened on Friday night during the game, we saw from the camera shot Beverly slide out of bounds. You can see the fan leaning over him, yelling. There's some dispute over Beverly, of course, said he was using profanities. The fan's wife says he was saying, "You suck," which conveniently rhymes with the profanity that Beverly said he used. But I tend to believe Pat's version of events, especially considering that there's a precedent for that particular guy being involved in controversial situations. He was back in his same seat doing the same thing, wasn't even disciplined by the league, so that's why I tend to see it from Pat's standpoint. He was fined, and the fans seemed to have received no discipline at all. Obviously, was not suspended or banned from the arena. He was back in the same seats pulling some of the same stunts on Sunday. So I can see the frustration from Pat Beverly's side of things. After the game, Pat went over there essentially to say, look, this is a basketball game. We need to be more professional. Beverly did not admit this in his comments. What we heard from fans nearby, what's important to note, when I read from fans nearby, no one thought this was a big deal. The only person pushing this as a big deal was the person involved, and I think it seems pretty clear by now it was a ploy to try and get Pat suspended, and thankfully it did not work. But what it seems like happening, Beverly said that he was basically defending, saying, hey, let's keep it professional, and piecing together what all parties have said, people there, and both Beverly's side and the owner's son's side, the wife of the fan put the clapper, the noisemaker, in Beverly's face, presumably to, shut him up, get him away, told him, you can't be here. And by the way, it wasn't in the stands, it was just to the side of the court, because it's courtside seating right behind the bucket. So, yeah, this whole thing of confronting a fan, no, this is not Vernon Maxwell going 30 rows into the stands. This is a guy that's right there. So that part was over-dramatized. The entire incident was over-dramatized. You could tell that the people affiliated with the owner's son had an axe to grind with this particular incident. Of course, you know there's no love lost for Patrick Beverly in Oklahoma City. But what ended up happening, Pat, I would not want someone putting a noisemaker flying in my face either, trying to shut me up. So I think he tried to push the noisemaker away, which is a common sense reaction. If somebody's putting a damn noisemaker right in front of your face, you're probably going to try and swat it away. According to the man who screamed, Patrick slapped my wife, Patrick slapped my wife. Oh, freaking please. If Patrick Beverly actually did any sort of damage or even intended to, yes, there were a lot of people around. This would have been a big story. The fact that it wasn't a big story, that you didn't have tons of people talking about this incident, no one even knew that it was going on for almost 24 hours, it was the definition of incidental contact. I guess you can find Pat because, yes, you can say no matter what, no good comes from going over there. I get Pat's frustration because he did try and deal with it with the proper channels he pointed out to the NBA officials, and they did nothing. So he felt he had to take matters into his own hands. You can make the argument that even so, there's nothing good that can possibly come from him going over there, only harm. But certainly he was not intending to do anything. No one was hurt. Did he get her arm, or did he get the noise device? Hard to say, because of course the noise device is connected to the arm, so there's a lot of gray area there. But obviously there was no intent to injure. No one actually was injured. There was no sort of violent incident at all. And if there were, in this day and age of social media, you would have had 50 million people talking about this, because that was a close game, a two-point Thunder win. Everyone was still there. This was seconds after the game. If this were that kind of incident, you can bet your life that it would have been reported thoroughly. This was just an innocuous, basically a civil conversation in which Pat Beverly went over there, tried to tell a guy who was yelling profanities during the game that's not appropriate. And by the way, Pat's exactly right. Just because you buy an NBA ticket and you have even have a higher threshold if you're the son of an owner sitting in owner seats, you don't have the right to just use profanities and make personal attacks. You can cheer, you can boo, you can do stuff like that, but you can't just go off personally attacking people, especially using profane language. Just having a ticket does not entitle you to do that. The NBA puts a premium on fan-player relations ever since the incident in Detroit. I think in 2004, Ron Artest, the Malice in the Palace, all that kind of stuff. And just as a premium on players can't do that, well, fans can't either. And so I think you have to draw a hard line. And Beverly did not want to respond. He asked the NBA to do something about it. Apparently, they did not. And maybe the fact that he's the owner's son plays into that. But regardless, it's pretty clear after the game that Pat Beverly went over there to have a civil conversation. Everyone agrees with that, even reading the interview that the owner's son had with Fred in the Norman transcript last night. He admits that Beverly was just saying, hey, he's a player, that this should not happen. And whatever happened after that, obviously the two of them did not respond in kind. It seems they actually tried to wave the clapper or noise making device in his face to shut him up. They actually tried to tell him that he can't be here, go to the back. And by the way, he's still on the court. He absolutely can be there. And of course, there ended up being some hurt feelings, but yeah, Patrick slapped my wife, BS. You were never once threatened, and I don't buy for a second a guy who's screaming F you at NBA players is that easily intimidated. This was a ploy to basically try and bait Pat Beverly and into some sort of incident that could compromise his availability during the series. It didn't work. The entire thing was, again, a ploy from the owner's son. It's sad that this was even a story, but in the day, it was a story. I give props to Fred for reporting it, because it's not like he did anything wrong. Fred, it's a big scoop for him. It's something, you know, it ended up being a $25,000 fine. It was one of the lead stories on ESPN. So yeah, it's a big feather in his cap. If it happened in Houston and I got the scoop, I report it the same way. Even if it didn't look good for someone with the Rockets, you get that information, you've got to go forward with the story. That's what journalists do. So it's a big get for Fred. But as far as what it means for the Rockets and the Thunder, I think it's ridiculous that Beverly was even fined. I'm thankful that he was not suspended, because quite frankly, the NBA should have done something themselves about this when Beverly pointed it out in the first half. And by the way, there are tons of other reporters who I respect that were there, most notably Jenny Dalcreach of the Houston Chronicle, who pointed out that the same fan was back in the same seats on Sunday doing similarly obnoxious things. So yeah, there's a repeated pattern of this. There's obviously a history with Pat in Oklahoma City, and thankfully the Rockets were able to get out of town with one of two wins there and hopefully not have to go back. There's no love lost now, especially after the game ended Sunday. I totally get Pat's frustration after everything he went through, saying, get the F out of here. You know, whatever taunts he had in the moment right after he had the ball as the clock went to zero. I totally get it. It will be even more awkward, even more boos, even more incidents if there's a game six, but the Rockets now have it fully within their destiny to end this series tomorrow night in Houston and not have to make another trip to Oklahoma City for several long months till, well, not as early as November and possibly a lot later than that. So a lot of reasons for the Rockets to wrap up this series tomorrow. Harden's ankle, the up and down results from the team as a whole in Oklahoma City, and of course the Pat Beverly storyline, all these things say one thing: end this series tomorrow in Game 5 and get yourself 6 days to rest before the second round starts on Monday, May 1st, against either the Spurs or the Grizzlies. So on that note, I will wrap up everything there. As always, appreciate all of y'all for listening. This is Locked On Rockets, your home for daily podcast coverage of the Houston Rockets. Follow us on Twitter at Locked On Rockets. Follow me on Twitter at Ben Dubose. And also email us, lockedonrockets@gmail.com. Any questions, suggestions, advertising inquiries, anything we can do to make this a better show for you, the Houston sports fan. Also on that note, we got a huge Lockdown Podcast Network, shows covering every NBA and NFL team. That includes your crosstown Houston Texans. NFL Draft is coming on later this week. Hopefully the Rockets will have their series wrapped up on Tuesday. That's another reason, so that we can all focus on the Texans and the draft on Thursday. Hopefully they're able to draft a quarterback, Pat Mahomes, Deshaun Watson out of Clemson. Those are a couple of the big names. Whatever happens, previewing the draft, recapping the draft, my buddy Robert Land over at Lockdown Texans. He will have you covered. If you haven't found his show, you can do so. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Audio Boom, tune in. Pretty much wherever you can find my show, Lockdown Rockets, on this Lockdown Podcast Network. You can also find Lockdown Texans simply by searching for Lockdown Texans. So for now, go out and enjoy the rest of your Monday, because Tuesday we are back to basketball, shoot around Tuesday morning, and then game 5, 7 p.m. Tuesday night, chance for the Rockets to close out the series and advance to the second round. Should be a fun atmosphere if you're a listener. If you haven't heard on Twitter, the Rockets are doing several initiatives to try and get fans there early. They're working with the city on better controlling traffic flow outside. They're offering dollar beers, dollar sodas, dollar nachos, dollar hot dogs from 5:30 to 6:30, all sorts of initiatives to get fans there early. We saw the atmosphere that was in Oklahoma City this weekend and the impact that they had on the game, specifically right out of the gate. I think that's a big part of how Oklahoma City was able to get out to such big starts. I think game 2, we all saw what a lackadaisical crowd it was in Toyota Center at the jump, and maybe that's why the Rockets came out a little soft in that game. So if everyone is in their seats by 7 tomorrow and ready to go, maybe that gives the Rockets an even better shot to go out and take care of business in Game 5 and in this series, well, within 24 hours. So in the meantime, go out and get your rest, and I look forward to seeing you guys, many of you, out at Toyota Center tomorrow night when the Rockets have their chance in Game 5 to close out the series and formally advance to the second round. For now, enjoy your evening.